Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So come on, let me know. It's indecision's bugging me.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ashley Tellis, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. Previously, he was commissioned into the Foreign Service and served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi and as senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He also served on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the President and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ashley Tellis.
But thank you, Ian.
And the agreement that was announced today in New Delhi between in a meeting at the beginning of a two-day meeting between the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. What do we know of it so far? I mean, what's been sketched out in the press releases is pretty thin. It is actually worth noting it's the first agreement that Afghanistan has gone into.
That is correct. The evidence that we have for the details right now, as you said, is very spotty. Two themes seem to appear in all the press reports. One, the Indian commitment to stand by Afghanistan for the long term, meaning beyond the security transition in 2014. And the second, the Indian willingness to continue supporting Afghan national security forces through training and possibly through other forms of assistance that might be mutually negotiated. These are the two elements that seem to have made all the headlines in the reporting so far.
But in terms of filling the strategic vacuum when the United States and NATO withdraw by 2014 or start their withdrawal by 2014, is that's finessed, because that would inflame Pakistan, wouldn't it? Any notion of replacing American and NATO troops with Indian troops?
I think that is right, but I don't think that is the Indian intent. I don't think the Indians are communicating a willingness to actually send troops into Afghanistan. What they appear to be saying is that they are prepared to backfill any deficits that may arise in terms of the raising and support of Afghan national security forces, which means, you know, bringing the officer corps to India and training them, probably providing some amounts of material equipment, depending on what the Indians, you know, have available at that point. So I think they're not really talking of Indian troops in Afghanistan, but rather simply strengthening Afghanistan's capacity to defend itself.
And given that Afghanistan is not a functioning state. It's not a failed state, but it's not a functioning state. And India has pledged, what, $2 billion in assistance. And they've also built a number of roads and some infrastructure already. But compare that to the $8 billion a month that the U.S. is spending. There's obviously a huge difference there.
Absolutely. And I don't think India can ever compensate for a U.S. withdrawal if that withdrawal is either comprehensive or complete. And so I think the Indian calculation going into a partnership with Karzai presumes that the United States will stay engaged at some level or another, and that all that India can do is, in a sense, substitute on the margins. And I think that is Karzai's calculation as well. This agreement that he has reached with India, first, just a couple of facts that may help put it in context. The agreement was actually ready to be signed when Prime Minister Singh visited Kabul in May earlier this year. But it was deferred being publicly announced, actually at Karzai's own request. And the fact that Karzai has now agreed, in fact pushed, to make the agreement public signals that his calculations are more strategic rather than simply related to, you know, some specific factual things that he may be getting from India.
Well, clearly they're timed in the aftermath of public acrimony expressed by the high United States officials, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen. Prior to that, dissatisfaction with Pakistan was apparently expressed privately by U.S. officials, but this is the first time that it's been publicly pretty much laid on the line by Mullen. The State Department has tried to do some backfilling there, and the president also. I suspect that one of the reasons why Mullen went public in the way that he did, with the intensity and indignation that he expressed, was that he's getting a lot of heat from his own officer corps, the generals and the majors and the captains inside of Afghanistan, who are absolutely furious that they're being essentially shot in the back by the Pakistanis.
And I think that's exactly right. I think Mullen stretched the talking points. He didn't stretch the truth. The fact of the matter is that today the sanctuary that Pakistan offers a variety of opponents of the alliance is something that is actually undermining what is supposedly a common effort in Afghanistan. And I think Mullen, like many others, had reached the end of his tether and decided to go public, first to signal that the United States is not oblivious to what Pakistan is doing, but second, and I think equally important, trying to force the Obama administration to at least change policy on some key issues pertaining to Pakistan.
But the incident that provoked this, allegedly members of the Haqqani network were able to take over a building under construction and shoot at the U.S. embassy all day. Prior to that, they set off a car bomb that wounded about 80 NATO soldiers. But apparently, in terms of Afghanistan's ire, it was the assassination of the peace envoy, former President Rabbani, who they've apparently captured a Pakistani who they're holding responsible for that assassination. So it would seem to me that that Karzai is really basically, I don't know whether he's poking the Pakistanis in the eye, but he certainly, I don't think this trip is coincidental.
No, and I agree with that completely. I think although the specific triggers that motivated Mullen to say what he did and the triggers that have moved Karzai to take this very public position of solidarity with India are different. The fact is, from Karzai's perspective, they are really two sides of the same problem. That is, whether it's the Haqqanis or whether it is other individuals, you know, who have been attacking his allies, he sees the problem as essentially a Pakistan which refuses to come to terms with the idea that Afghanistan could be both capable and independent. And so from his vantage point, he sees Pakistan as essentially being the root of all evils that face his country. And at this point, when he is somewhat uncertain about what the security transition means from the point of view of American commitment over the long term, he thinks it is useful to send a signal to Pakistan that he has other arrows in the quiver. And a very important arrow for him is, of course, India, because he is hoping that if nothing else, a public expression of solidarity with India will force Islamabad to, in a sense, rethink its current strategy towards Kabul. Now, whether that pays off remains to be seen, but he's at least, you know, attempting to exercise these other gambits, because I think he finds himself running out of options.
But Ashley Tellis, again, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, there isn't one Pakistan. It's often said that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And what upset Mullen was directed at ISI and the military. But the government, of course, the civilian government, weak as it is had to defend the nation's honor, as it were. So there seems to be two governments here. The permanent one, the military one.
They always have been.
Yeah, but I understand that the civilian government, weak as it is actually trying to mend fences with India.
And that has been true for a while. In fact, when President Zardari, ascended to office, he did launch peace overtures and has been trying to kind of put the building blocks, you know, for a peace process in place. The difficulty is that on the key issues that matter in the India-Pakistan relationship, those key issues which have to do with national security, that have to do with the use of jihadist proxies, which have to do with the nuclear weapons programs, and the way Pakistan reacts to India's presence in Afghanistan, on all these issues, it's the Pakistan army that calls the shots. And so, yes, President Zardari does find himself in a somewhat awkward situation that he has to, in a sense, run interference and protect Pakistan's honor, as you pointed out, because the Pakistan army has been, you know, taking it in the neck, you know, as a result of both American and Afghan complaints. But that's unfortunately the history of Pakistan, and, you know, I think Zardari is just doing the best he can to cope with what are very difficult political circumstances at home.
But what's the U.S. doing here apart from getting out? I understand that when Holbrooke came in and was given that job as being the special envoy between for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he wanted to have a global authority also over the Indian portfolio and try to settle the Kashmir issue, figuring that if you settle the animosity between Pakistan and India, then Afghanistan becomes less of a problem. That seems pretty logical to me. He got nowhere with that.
I think the theory is absolutely right. I think the practice is going to be harder to implement, because if you think fixing Afghanistan and Afghan-Pakistan and India-Pakistan relations is hard enough, fixing Kashmir first as the prerequisite to doing everything else right, I think, is an even harder task. I mean, a solution to Kashmir has eluded us for 60 years. And as long as the Pakistan army has the attitude that it does to Kashmir, I don't think you're going to find a solution anytime soon. So my problem with Holbrooke was not the theory, but in a sense, he ended up putting, you know, the cart before the horse. I think you will get a solution to Kashmir as a result of India-Pakistan reconciliation and not the other way around.
But what thwarted Holbrooke was pressure from India, not from Pakistan.
Well, yes, of course. But the problem still remains the same, that there was simply no way in which Holbrooke could have engineered a solution to Kashmir. The Indians and the Pakistanis, from 2003 to 2007, actually had a very productive set of conversations about the future of Kashmir and what the solution might be. And President Musharraf had actually signed on to an agreement in principle, which General Kiani walked away from. And so I think from an Indian perspective, until they got very clear signals that General Kiani was willing to, in a sense, go back to the negotiating table and carry that framework agreement that the Indians and Pakistanis had in principle, they had absolutely no interest in seeing Holbrooke interject himself into something that, you know, most people who look at this closely agree is better solved by Indians and Pakistanis alone.
Not that it has. You just said they've got nowhere in 60 years.
Well, they did make progress in
the last decade. Sure.
And the interesting thing is that progress has been most conspicuous when the United States has stood out.
Well, but we also know that when Indian and Pakistan start to get together, when their foreign ministers meet, for example, recently they met, and on the very moment that they met, the Mumbai attack happened. It's not hard to figure out what that's all about.
That's exactly right.
So what's happening now with Zardari and Manmohan Singh? Because Zardari seems to be quite genuine in trying to work something out here.
Well, the difficulty that we have in India-Pakistan relations is that the part of the Pakistan government that deeply cherishes a peace with India, which is the civilians, that part of the government is essentially powerless to make that peace.
I see.
And the part of the government that is capable of making the peace, which is the army, has its own interests in a continued standoff with India. And until this circle can be squared on the Pakistani end, I don't think you're going to get a very successful peace process. Now, what happened between 2003 and 2007 is that for the first time, the Pakistan army, in the person of General Musharraf, was actually eager to consummate this peace. And it's really unfortunate that General Musharraf ended up exiting office in the circumstances that he did before he was able to, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's on the agreement.
Sure. It's one of those things like it takes a Nixon to make a deal with communist China.
That's exactly it.
So just in closing then, Ashley, tell us, there is in this agreement about which we know little, but there have been some details announced that between Afghanistan and India that's been announced today in the state visit of President Karzai. Apparently it involves some energy issues involving pipelines, and we know that there's been a lot of talk about that forever. Afghanistan has signed a transit trade agreement with Pakistan that allowed agricultural products from Afghanistan to cross Pakistan into India. That's a good sign. Would they be able to allow a pipeline from which they could both benefit?
There is no reason why that, you know, can't and shouldn't happen. There has been a negotiation now for what is called a TAPI pipeline, which is a Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, which the U.S. is very strongly backing. And if the Afghan-Pakistan transit trade agreement can actually be expanded to go beyond agricultural products to small manufacturers and energy, I think that would be a win-win for all the three countries involved.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ashley Tellis.
A pleasure to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Ashley Tellis, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He previously was commissioned into the Foreign Service and served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi. He was also senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and served on the National Security Council staff as a special assistant to the President and senior director for strategic planning in Southwest Asia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the health of President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela.